Well, the word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the Jews which dwell in the land of Egypt. Now, God singles them out. They can't hide out. They can't escape. They can't get away no matter what. Concerning all the Jews that dwell in the land of Egypt, which dwell at Migdol, at Tapanes, at Noph, and in the country of Pathros. So these are all areas that are segments of Egypt. Noph was the city of Memphis later. You read about Migdol in Exodus 14 and verse 2. If you want to track down some of these. Of course, Pathros is a part of Upper Egypt, south of Memphis. We've read about it in Isaiah 11. You can read about it, we will later, in Ezekiel 29 and 30. So these are just major centers of Egypt, where these Jews now were dwelling in a, they thought, of security. Thus says the Eternal Host, the God of Israel, you've seen all the calamity or evil that I've brought upon Jerusalem and upon all the cities of Judah. And behold, this day they're a desolation, and no man dwells therein. Because of the evil, same word as verse 2, rea in the Hebrew, that they've committed to provoke me to anger, in that they went to burn incense and to serve other gods, whom they knew not, neither they, you, nor your fathers. Howbeit, I sent to you all my servants the prophets, rising early and sending them, saying, oh, do not this abominable thing that I hate. But they didn't hearken. They wouldn't even incline their ear when God Almighty was speaking to turn from their evil, to burn no incense to other gods. Wherefore, God's fury and his anger was poured forth and was kindled in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. They're wasted and desolate as at this day. So even when Jeremiah had already gone and escaped down into Egypt, those cities back in the land of Judah were wasted and desolate at the day he's recording this down there in Tapanes. Therefore, now thus says the Eternal God of hosts, the God of Israel, wherefore commit you this great evil against your souls? Now there again, how can you imagine committing a great evil against your souls? Cutting off from you man and woman, child and suckling. There again, God revealing himself in four, categorizes man, woman, child, suckling. Out of Judah. Of course, this time he uses the word child, which just means little one, even smaller than the one he's been using earlier. Out of Judah, to leave you none to remain, in that you provoke me into wrath with the works of your hands, burning incense unto other gods in the land of Egypt, whether you be gone to dwell, that you might cut yourself off, that you might be a curse and a reproach. Now notice this. Among all the nations of the earth. Now that's a key prophecy about Judah. God said about Simeon, he would scatter him in Israel. So you don't ever read about the tribe of Simeon independently later. They just, in a sense, got replaced by the two sons of Joseph. And yet Simeon was just scattered among the 12 tribes. They weren't scattered into all the nations of the earth. But you know, you find Jews all over the earth, in all the nations of the earth. And that's what God had said. Because of their rebellion and disobedience and their failure to hearken and obey God and trust God and have faith in God, they were going to be a curse and a reproach among all the nations of the earth. Spanish Jews, Norwegian Jews, Russian Jews, Armenian Jews, African Jews, Japanese Jews. That's what it says. Those Jews were going to be scattered among all the nations of the earth, and among all the nations of the earth where they're scattered, they would be a curse and a reproach. Boy, that's one of the most fulfilled prophecies you've ever read. If you saw the fiddler on the roof, you saw that prophecy fulfilled. If you read about the Jews anywhere on earth and the way they've been dealt with, you're fulfilling or seeing fulfilled Jeremiah 44:8 all over again. Going on, then he says, have you forgotten the evil? Same rea in Hebrew. Notice how one time they translated evil, another time wickedness, another time calamity. It's too bad it isn't more consistent. Have you forgotten the evil of your fathers and the evil of the kings of Judah and the evil of their wives and of your own evil and the evil of your wives, which they've committed in the land of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. And when God is really specifically zeroing in on each class, he really blew it here. He should have included some of the 10 tribes. If there had been enough of them brought, come back down there in order to make a number of a tribe. But you know, that's what the Church of God Seventh Day says. Mr. Lawson's brother wrote that in their Bible Advocate. And when he used to come back to Kansas City, we'd always go up to Stanbury and visit. And after he wrote that article, I took it back up there. And I told him, you're going to be accountable. You've taken scriptures out of Hosea, and you've directly misused them. Now let me show you the context of those scriptures, now you misused them. And he just got red-faced and got embarrassed. I said, if I were in your shoes, I'd write an article correcting that, because you're going to be accountable for people's lives that might be coming into the knowledge of who Israel is, and they've read your inaccurate material, and you're going to be answerable for their blood. You know, he just kind of got embarrassed and got a little bit upset, and since then he's gotten shuffled out of there into another area. And at that time, he was right at their headquarters, right at their college, the pastor of their headquarters church. Very plainly, God shows you, he doesn't say a word here about any stragglers of Israel. He talks about your wickedness, your father's wickedness, the kings of Judah's, the king's wives, you people who fled out of there and came down into Egypt, your wickedness, and your wives, they've been a party to it, it's their wickedness. You've all committed that in the land of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. Now, in the contrast to that, look what should have happened to people. You should have been contrite or humble to this day. You haven't feared. You haven't walked in my law, nor in my statutes. You notice the captivity came because they didn't walk in God's statutes, not just 10 commandments. And yet Adventists, Seventh-day Church of God, they'd have you believe that statutes are rituals. Ah, those holy days, that's Armstrongism. That's a bunch of ritual. Well, that's not what your Bible ever says. You read back in Exodus, the statutes and judgments were a part of the law given at Mount Sinai on that very same day, and God would have spoken them all himself if the people hadn't interceded. And anybody that tries to tell you statutes and judgments were a law that was added later, don't know what they're talking about. They weren't added later, any such thing. There's no time change between Exodus 20 and 21. There's no time change all the way until Moses went back up with Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and the 70 elders. And then he gave them all the instruction about the tent and the ritual and the altars and the ceremonies. And they didn't start practicing that until almost a year later. No other church believes that. Church of God Seventh Day doesn't know that. Adventists don't know that. They'll tell you about how they put the 10 commandments in the Ark of the Covenant. And they'll tell you the 10 commandments are the covenant. And that's a farce. That's not true at all. That's only a part of the covenant. It's only the introductory summary. Well, it's like the Jews, you know. They tell you circumcision was the covenant, and that isn't true either. Circumcision was the token of the covenant. Like the crosses Catholics wear around their necks, a token of their Christianity. But notice what God requires for people to not rebel against him, to be blessed by him. You have to be contrite or humble. You have to fear God. You have to walk in God's law and in God's statutes. It means pay your tithes and keep the holy days. That's what statutes are, that I set before you and your fathers. That wasn't added later. Levites didn't give you that. I set those before you and before your fathers. Therefore, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will set my face against you for evil and to cut off all Judah. No Israelites. I'm going to take the remnant of Judah, no Israelites, that have set their faces to go into the land of Egypt, to sojourn there. They're going to all be consumed. They're appointed to the sword and death. They're going to fall in the land of Egypt. They're going to be consumed by the sword and by the famine. They're going to die from the least to the greatest, by the sword and by the famine. And there again he repeats this fourfold judgment, God revealing himself. I'm going to punish them that dwell in the land of Egypt as I've punished Jerusalem. And he mentions the big three again of the punishment. so that none of the remnant of Judah, which are gone into the land of Egypt to sojourn there, shall escape or remain. That they should return into the land of Judah, none of them are going to go back, to the which they have a desire to return to dwell there. But they're not, it's not going to work out. Here again, the Hebrew word is soul in verse 14. Their soul desires to return. See to your emotions, the life of your emotions. None shall return but such as shall escape. And they're the ones that didn't go down there willingly, but were forced to go. Then all the men which knew that their wives had burned incense to other gods, and all the women that stood by, a great assembly, even all the people that dwelt in the land of Egypt and Pathros, answered Jeremiah, saying, as for the word that you've spoken to us in the name of the Eternal, we're not going to hearken to you. We're going to certainly do whatsoever thing goes forth out of our own mouth. We're going to do as we please. We're going to burn incense to Easter. Well, you're not going to keep us from keeping Easter. We've been keeping Easter for a long time. We're going to go right on. We're going to pour out drink offerings to Easter, as we've done. We and our fathers, our kings and our princes, in the cities of Judah, and in the streets of Jerusalem. Why, at least back then, we had plenty of bread, and we were well, and saw no evil. But since we've left off burning incense to the Queen of Heaven, and you know, this is what may well happen in America once again, too. People are going to say, why, you remember back when we first came here and brought all of our Christmas and Easter and Halloween and April Fool's Days and all the other Fool's Days, and remember how prospered and blessed and how rich and how great we were? And now sundowners, pessimists like Armstrong, come along and get us away from all those roots of Christianity. You know, a lot of the books that write against us talk about how we speak against historical Christianity, not biblical Christianity. Historical. They just misspell it. It ought to be hysterical instead of historical. But notice the attitude that's going to happen again. They're going to say, well, remember how blessed this country was back when our fathers first came here and brought all of Christianity? Why, we had as many Sunday regulations as they had Sabbath regulations. And you know, that's true. I've got a big, fat, thick book at home called Lord's Day Regulations in Puritan New England. And it's just as thick as the Jewish Talmud, what all you can and can't do on Sunday. Now, they're going to say, well, remember back when we had that freedom of religion and we were all following Christianity and why, we had food and we were well and we saw no evil. But since some of these modernists and these sundowners and pessimistic sects have torn down our Christianity, those JWs and Adventists disagreeing about immortal souls and ever-burning hells, and JWs disputing the Trinity doctrine, and since we left off following our religions, burning incense to Easter and pouring out drink offerings to Easter, we've wanted all. We've been consumed by the sword and by the famine. And when we burned incense to Easter and poured out drink offerings to her, did we make her cakes to worship her and pour out drink offerings to her without our men? We weren't worshiping idols. You just go through the idols to the gods. They aren't the idols. Why, they're just symbols or representatives of the gods. Then Jeremiah said unto all the people, to the men and to the women, and to all the people which had given him that answer, saying, the incense that you burned in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, you and your fathers, your kings and your princes, and the people of the land, didn't the Eternal remember them? And came it not into his mind, so that the Eternal could no longer bear because of the evil, could no longer forbear, cease to act because of all these gods and religious practices, because of the abominations you've committed? Therefore your land is a desolation, an astonishment, and a curse, without an inhabitant. And there again, God revealing himself with a fourfold judgment. Your land's a desolation, an astonishment, a curse, and without an inhabitant. So again and again, you see that number four carrying on the number God revealing himself. Because you burned incense, because you've missed the mark, Cheta, against the Eternal, and you have not obeyed the voice of the Eternal, nor walked in his law, nor in his statutes, nor in his testimonies. Now, he even goes one better there and adds another one. So how do you not obey? Not just the Ten Commandments. All the way through the Bible, sin, missing the mark, and not obeying are all tied in with statutes and judgments, not just the Ten Commandments. So don't let any Lutherans or Adventists or Church of God Seventh Day kid you. When you don't obey God's statutes, you sin. When you don't obey God's testimonies or judgments, you don't obey the voice of the Eternal. Therefore, evil happens to you, as it did to them at that day. Well, moreover, Jeremiah said to all the people and to all the women, hear the word of the Eternal, all Judah. That's all there are. Nobody else there that are in the land of Egypt. Now, that's not all of Judah. That's all that's in the land of Egypt. A lot of them are already in Babylon, most of them. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, saying, you and your wives have not spoken with your mouths and fulfilled with your hand, saying, we'll surely perform our vows. We vowed to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven. So you just think you are. You're not going to do that, pouring out drink offerings to Easter. You're going to surely accomplish your vows and surely perform your vows. Therefore, you hear the word of the Eternal, all Judah that dwell in the land of Egypt. Behold, I've sworn by my great name, says the Eternal, that my name shall no more be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt. Now, that'd be mighty hard to accomplish, wouldn't it? You think God could commit himself to something like that? To just draw a line and say, from this day forward, I swear by my name, my great name, my name's no more going to be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt. Well, he's going to have to get Jeremiah out of there then, because Jeremiah is going to swear or use God's name. And yet, God committed himself by an oath. He swore by his great name that his name would no more be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt. So Jeremiah couldn't have stayed in the land of Egypt then. He had to get out of there. He had to leave. He had to go somewhere. Well, where did he go? And kind of interestingly enough, even in the Companion Bible, they say, well, where did he go? They don't know either, you know, but they know he must have gone somewhere, because look what God said there, saying the Lord Eternal lives. Behold, I'll watch over them for evil and not for good, and all the men of Judah that are in the land of Egypt shall be consumed by the sword and by the famine until there be an end of them. Yet a small number that escape the sword shall return out of the land of Egypt into the land of Judah. Now, right away you think, well, I wonder if that's what's going to happen to the king's daughters then. Jeremiah with these king's daughters are going to take them back up to Judah, and where are they going to go from there? That land's desolate. You'll see a little later, somebody else enters in right away when all the people are removed out of it. Yet a small number shall return out of the land of Egypt into the land of Judah. And all the remnant of Judah that are gone into the land of Egypt to sojourn there shall know whose word shall stand, mine or theirs. And this will be a sign to you, says the Eternal, I'll punish you in this place, that you may know that my word shall surely stand against you for evil. Thus says the Eternal, behold, I'm going to give Pharaoh Hophra, king of Egypt, into the hand of his enemies, and into the hand of them that seek his life. And unbeknownst to him at the time, that wasn't Nebuchadnezzar God was talking about, but the monuments of archaeology tell you there were soldiers who were revolting against Pharaoh Hophra right at this time. And later he was delivered into their hands, and just like God said, his life ended exactly the way he said. But first God gave Pharaoh Hophra, king of Egypt, into the hand of his enemies, and into the hand of those that seek his life. There again they seek his soul. Hebrew word's nephesh. They're going to try to kill his soul. You know, even we say, well, bless my soul. As I gave Zedekiah, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, his enemy, that sought his soul. Well, the word that Jeremiah the prophet spake to Baruch. Now you're going to find out why the people earlier had blamed Baruch for misinforming Jeremiah and saying, well, God didn't tell you that. This is just your sorry counselor. He's giving you bad counsel, and he hadn't given you the right information. And now you find out why they could have said that, because even Jeremiah has to rebuke Baruch here in this very brief passage. Now the word of Jeremiah the prophet spake to Baruch, the grandson of Messiah, one of the governors of Jerusalem, back in Josiah's day. If you want to mark that back in chronology, 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 8. In the 18th year of Josiah's reign, when he had purged the land and the house, he sent Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, and Maaseiah, the governor of the city. 2 Chronicles 34, 8. Okay, back to Baruch anyway, the son of Neriah. When he had written these words in a book at the mouth of Jeremiah, so now you go back in the time period to the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah. So God has finished the accounting now about what's going to happen to all those descendants, and now he's going to begin to tell you about why that statement was made about him lying, being misled by Baruch. So, you know, the way the Bible is written, it'll carry a thing through, and then all of a sudden there'll be a backtracking to explain one of the minor details about this story flow that's been given previously. And you take the account of the creation. You know, God gives you the summary in the first chapter, and of course the Sabbath part should be also in the first chapter. And then right after that, he goes back and says, now let me fill in some details. And then he begins to tell you more detail about a few of the creation days, not all of them. Well, great scholars that don't look with awe and respect at scriptures take a look at that and they can't figure that out. So they think it's parts of two different segments that were preserved at different times and gives two different accounts of creation that don't even harmonize. And that isn't true at all. Those two chapters harmonize. If you understand the way God has the Bible written, and he does that quite often. Now let's read and see what this is about Baruch that was written way back in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, two kings earlier. Thus says the Eternal God of Israel to you, O Baruch. You did say, woe is me now. So at a time of a warning against the whole nation, his mind was on himself. And literally, I think chapter 45 applies to some men in our day that were in the work of God, that were out warning about what was going to happen on the world. And then all of a sudden, like Baruch, they began to seek great things for themselves. Instead of always thinking about the work, you know, God always tests men. I mentioned to the refresher group, I think God always puts everybody through what you might call a second conversion. And once God develops you and works with you and uses you, then all of a sudden he's going to have to kind of set you aside to see if you'll just stay in it because it's the truth. Or if you finally get to where you're in it because of the position you're in and who you are. You know, we've had men in the past that went from who's who to who's he. And what happens to you when that happens to you, you know? I know Mr. Apartian called one time, and I was out in West Texas, and he said, well, you know, Dean, he said, I don't know what God's trying to show me or what God has in mind, you know. I'd like to be active and do more in the work, and, you know, I don't know what to do. And his wife had said, well, you know, D-Bar, God knows what you can do. Now he wants to know what you can take. And I said, well, you know, you got some pretty good wisdom there. That's good counsel. But I think God has done that with everybody I've ever known, including Mr. Armstrong, including every man that I know of that's been anywhere in the higher echelons in the ministry. God has always put them through a test later on to see if you're going to stick with it just because it's the truth. I remember one minister I visited one time that had been dropped out of the ministry and suspended from church. And I said, well, do you remember back when you first heard the truth? Remember when you were so excited about seeing the truth and how tickled and pleased and delighted you were? And you weren't anybody then. And now you're not back where you were. Why aren't you happy now? Well, he got to be somebody and got to be in a position, and sooner or later, God wanted to see if he'd just stick in there just because it's the truth. Well, some don't do that. God didn't put this one passage in here to continually punch old Baruch in the nose and give him black eyes forever. You know, this is prophecy, and it's prophecy for everybody anytime. Now, of course, Baruch was a counselor of the servant of God. And we've had a lot of counselors of the servant of God. I remember one man that was told to do some research and get material and put in a lot of time, and he took time away from his family and worked late, got together all his material, and went into the meeting on the fourth floor and presented his material, and it was all overlooked, and the decision was made contrary to it anyway. Well, you know, the man came out of the meeting red-faced and red-necked and angry, and one of the other top men confronted him right on the fourth floor and said, "Well, what's the matter?" You know, he didn't hide his countenance at all. He just said, "Well, I put in all this work and sacrifice my time and take time away from my family, and after all this effort and go in and put it, and they consider it, and every decision made contrary to it." And the man said, "Well, yeah, but what's the problem?" You know, that's the problem right there. He thought he was supposed to be in on the decision, or thought he was supposed to, he didn't know the difference between input and helping make a decision. Well, he's not in the church anymore, and he was one of the top men in the work. Well, Jeremiah 45 is a frightening chapter to me, because if Mr. Armstrong looks on you as a counselor, boy, you got to watch out. At a time when your concern ought to be for people and the country and the land and God's people, if you, at a time like that, seek great things for yourself, boy, oh boy, your name's going to be mud, like Baruch's name is mud for years. It's always right here in Jeremiah 45. Now, you know, you might want to read your name into there sometime. The word that Jeremiah the prophet spake to Dean. Boy, I don't like to read it that way, but it does me good to read it that way. When he'd written these words, "Thus says the Eternal God of Israel to you, O Baruch, you did say, woe is me now, for the Eternal has added grief to my sorrow. I fainted in my sighing, and I find no rest." So apparently he was a man that had hopes and desires and goals and ideas, and all of a sudden all this sundown prophecy was against all his hopes and dreams. "Thus shall you say to him, the Eternal says thus, behold, that which I have built will I break down." After all, Baruch, look, I'm the one that built it. And if I decide to break it down, what's your complaint? "That which I have built will I break down. That which I have planted, I will pluck up, even this whole land." And really the key is verse 5. "And seek you great things for yourself?" Would you seek to secure great things for yourself? At a time like this, you're thinking about, woe is me. Oh, there go my plans. There goes my future. There goes my prosperity. There goes my position. Oh, woe is me. And you're seeking great things for yourself at a time of calamity prophesied? "Behold, I bring evil upon all flesh," is God's oracle. "But your soul I'm going to give to you for a prey in all places where you go." You're not going to pay with your life, but I'm displeased with you, Baruch. Look at you. At a time like that, you're thinking about yourself. Boy, you know, that's a warning for all of us. At a time when things are prophesied about the world and Israel, and you got your mind on yourself, when you're in a work of God warning the world about Armageddon and calamity and captivity, and your mind is on yourself? Yeah, chapter 45 is written for every one of us. Don't ever just read Baruch's name in there. If you'd fail to read your own name in there, you're liable to duplicate it and fulfill it. It's liable to be accomplished on you. You know, I've heard Mr. Armstrong say many a time, and I was going to give a sermon on that the next time I got to preach here in Pasadena. I've heard him say many a time, Satan is so happy to have you so busy in the work that you don't have time to study and pray and spend with your family and your wife. How many people is that true of? I've been kind of shocked since I've been out here a year and a half. How many people think just because they're employed and active in the work that they're headed right into the kingdom, they're bound to make it? No, no, you're not either. I'm not bound to make it, and neither one of you are bound to make it. Doesn't make any difference whether you're directly in the work or not. You know, you think because you're in the work and you're at Pasadena, then that doesn't mean you ought to be praying and studying and fasting, and it doesn't mean you ought to be fulfilling these obligations. Well, even more so, it ought to mean you. But the way some people's lives are conducted, you sure wouldn't believe they think that. Well, chapter 46, isn't that one of the biggest little chapters in the Bible there, though? For you and me, that might be one of the biggest chapters in the Bible. Well, the word of the Eternal that came to Jeremiah the prophet way back at the same time chapter 45 did. So now that he's gone back to the fourth year of Jehoiakim, now he goes ahead and gives you more. And from this time forward, he prophesies all the calamities against the Gentiles. So he finished with Judah, and now for the rest of the book, he's going to tell you about what's going to happen to Gentile nations. Except for one chapter. You'll never find a prophet that ends on a negative note. That's really unusual. Even Obadiah, only one chapter. There's only one book in all the Bible that ends on a negative note that it could anyway be tied in with prophecy, and that's Lamentations. But that's not really a prophecy as much as it is when all these things God foretold happen. God had him sit there and watch it all happen and write his laments as it all happened all around him. And that's what anybody that's left behind in the coming calamity, all the Laodiceans, would be writing a book of Lamentations also. Because they're going to be there to see it. They're not going to be taken to any place of final training and escape it. But every other book, including Jeremiah, is going to end positive. Now the word of the Eternal that came to Jeremiah against the nations, first of all, he picks on Egypt. Because after all, they're the one Judah's trusting in. They're the one that they had their confidence in. So he picks on them first. Against the army of Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, which was by the river Euphrates in Carchemish, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, smote in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. And so now he's going to address this punishment on the little country of Egypt. Order you the buckler and shield, and draw near to battle. Prepare and put in order. Harness the horses. Get up, you horsemen. Stand forth with your helmets. Furbish the spears. Put on your coats of mail. Wherefore have I seen them dismayed, turned away back? Their mighty ones are beaten down. Now all of a sudden, this great power of Egypt going up against Babylon, and look at them. Instead of their pride in their armory and their battlements, now they're dismayed and turned away back. And their mighty ones are crushed, beaten down. They're fled apace, fled in flight. Look not back. Terror was round about them, says the Eternal. Let not the swift flee away, nor the mighty man, and there's the one Hebrew word, Geber, they'll stumble and fall toward the north by the river Euphrates. So here again, a duality of prophecy, the same king of the south in the end time is going to meet his calamity when the king of the north comes on him, as Daniel says, just like it happened back in this antitype. Who is this that comes up as a flood? So here he's likening the great Egyptian power to their great river, the Nile, as it breaks out of its banks and floods. And so God likens the Egyptian power to the great Nile flooding. Egypt rises up like a flood. His waters are moved like the rivers. He says, I'll go up, I'll cover the earth. And at this time when this was written, Egypt was so strong that Jeremiah's prophecy would seem absolutely impossible. I'm going to destroy the city and the inhabitants thereof. Talking about Babylon and the other great world power. Come up, you horses, and rage, you chariots. Let the mighty men come forth. Now he begins to zero in on their allies, the Ethiopians, the Libyans, the Lydians. And if you remember Daniel 11, you read about those same ones again. In fact, in Ezekiel, you're going to find all of these allies enumerated. So now you have Libya, Egypt, Ethiopia, Lydia. All of these are in northern Africa that handle and bend the bow. For this is the day of the Lord Eternal of Hosts, a day of vengeance on the Egyptians, that he may avenge him of his adversaries. And the sword is going to devour, it's going to be satiate, it's going to be bathed with their blood. Made drunk is kind of a bad translation. For the Lord Eternal of Hosts has a sacrifice in the north country by the river Euphrates. Now, if you remember, we read that in Isaiah 34 and verse 6, too. The Eternal has a sacrifice in the north country. You're going to read it again in Ezekiel 39 and verse 17, showing the continuity and harmony of the major prophets. Go up into Gilead. Take balm, O virgin, the daughter of Egypt. And that said kind of a tongue-in-cheek. In vain you'll use many medicines. You're not going to be cured. Hebrew more says, healing there's none for you. Instead of, you're not going to be cured. The nations have heard of your shame, and your cry has filled the earth, because the mighty man has stumbled against the mighty. They're both fallen together. The word that the Eternal spake to Jeremiah the prophet, how Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, should come and smite the land of Egypt. Declare you in Egypt. Publish in Migdol. Here he begins to highlight these areas of Egypt once again. Publish in Noph or Memphis and Tapanes and say, stand fast and prepare you, because the sword shall devour round about you. Why are your valiant men swept away? They stood not because the Eternal did drive them. Their God allowed a terror and a fear and a fleeing to take hold on them, and they wouldn't stand and fight. He made many to fall. Yea, one fell upon another. They said, arise, let's go again to our own people, to the land of our nativity, from the oppressing sword. They did cry there. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, lied to us. He's a windbag. He promised us all of this, told us all of this, and now it hadn't happened. He's past the time appointed. His time has passed. We should have gotten rid of him earlier. So like God said, some of his own men were out to take his life because he lied. He misled them. He promised world rule, and look what he got. And there's duality. There's going to come a voice out of Egypt again that's going to promise success, and they're going to threaten other nations on earth with oil bribes, and then they're going to get smashed because of it. And then they're going to be hated again by the people that say, look, our leaders lied. Their time's up. As I live, says the king, whose name is the Eternal of Hosts, surely as Tabor is among the mountains, as Carmel by the sea, so he shall come. So just as sure as those mountains are famous and still there, you be sure Nebuchadnezzar is going to come right down into these cities, and he's going to do exactly what I've told you. And now, after kind of poking fun of the virgin daughter of Egypt in verse 11, now he talks about his people dwelling in Egypt. O you daughter, dwelling in Egypt, furnish yourself to go into captivity. For Noph shall be waste and desolate, without an inhabitant. Now, when we were over there in 64, you know, Memphis still had some statues there and a few people there. But in the end, there's going to be nobody there. It's going to be waste and desolate. Egypt is like a very fair heifer, which again was one of their sacred gods, the sacred bull. So God likens them to one of their gods. But destruction's going to come against this Egypt. It's going to come out of the north. Just like Daniel 11 says. Also her hired men, these other countries surrounding them that they bought off with their promises, her hired men are in the midst of her like fatted bullocks. They also are turned back and fled away together. So they were broken all together. They thought if they could get a number united in North Africa, they'd have a chance against the power in Europe. They did not stand. They fled. They were given a spirit of fear because the day of their calamity was come on them and the time of their visitation. The voice thereof shall go like a serpent, for they shall march with an army and come against her with axes as hewers of wood. They'll cut down her forest, says the Eternal, though it cannot be searched, because they are more than the grasshoppers, and they are innumerable. The daughter of Egypt shall be confounded. So here again, the term daughter of Egypt, showing he's not talking about the mother back in the old days, but he's talking about a later descendant known as a daughter. So even the same daughter of Egypt is going to be defeated by the power of the north. They're going to be allied with these United Arab Republic, all the countries around them, and they're going to promise them success, and they're going to fail. The daughter of Egypt shall be confounded. She's going to be delivered into the hand of the people of the north. The Eternal Host, the God of Israel, says. So you notice, even when God isn't talking about any of Israel, even when he's talking about Egyptians and Babylonians and Ammonites and Moabites, Philistines, he's still called the God of Israel. That doesn't have a thing to do with who he's talking about. It doesn't mean they're all Israel just because he's termed the God of Israel. He's always the God of Israel, the God of Jacob. The Eternal Host, the God of Israel, says, behold, I'll punish the multitude of Noah and Pharaoh and Egypt with their gods and their kings. So you see, they're a combined power. They're not just one country. They're kings united together. Pharaoh and all them that trust in him. They had belief in him. They had confidence in him. He gave them great promises. I'll deliver them into the hand of those that seek their souls. There again, the word soul. And into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of his servants, and afterward it'll be inhabited, as in the days of old. So that's talking about this final coming captivity, because God says, after this takes place, it's going to be inhabited as in the days of old. But fear not you, O my servant Jacob. And here he uses the name of all the tribes, the natural seed, the whole nation. So now instead of using any other title, he comes back to my servant Jacob. Don't be dismayed, O Israel. Behold, I'm going to save you from afar off. I'm going to save your seed from the land of their captivity. Now, why in the world would he bring that in when he's just been talking about the final battle between the Egyptians and the Babylonians? And now all of a sudden, he talks about his people Israel that are still in a captivity. Well, they've already been taken captive before this takes place between the daughter of Egypt and Babylon. They've already been taken captive. So after he describes what's going to happen in the end time at the fifth trumpet to these United Arab Republic against the king of the north, he turns and says, oh, that's right, I remember you. Don't think I've forgotten you, O my servant Jacob. Don't be dismayed, O Israel. Behold, I'm going to save you from afar off. I'm going to save your seed from the land of their captivity. Jacob's going to return and be in rest. The seventh day Sabbath of 1,000 years. Always referred to rest, the millennium. A Sabbath, 1,000-year rest. And at ease. None are going to make him afraid. That's a millennial picture. At ease. No one making afraid. Fear you not, O Jacob, my servant, says the Eternal, for I am with you. I'm going to make a full end of all the nations, whither I've driven you, but I'm not going to make a full end of you. In other words, they're going to cease being in authority. They're going to cease being rulers and powers, but not you. I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to correct you in measure, but I'm not going to leave you wholly unpunished. I can't hold you guiltless. I've got to chasten and punish you because you've misrepresented God and the Bible and Christianity to the world. But I'm going to cause these nations to have a full end made of them. They're not going to be in authority and power anymore. Then the word of the Eternal that came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Philistines before that Pharaoh smote Gaza. So here you right away see where the Philistines are, the coastlands of the Mediterranean in Palestine. Thus says the Eternal, behold, waters rise up out of the north. So now as he had likened the great power of Egypt to their Nile River, now he talks about the power of the north rising up also like a flood of waters, an overflowing flood. overflowing the land, all that's therein. And you know, that terminology is used in Daniel 11. It says they'll even flood over, overflow. Now he talks about the city and them that dwell therein. Then the men are going to cry, and all the inhabitants of the land are going to howl. At the noise of the stamping of the hoofs of his strong horses, at the rattling or rushing of his chariots, at the rumbling of his wheels, the fathers are not going to look back to their children for feebleness of hands. It's going to be such a terrifying, frightening thing to realize these hordes of the king of the north, like waters flooding, because of the day that comes to spoil all the Philistines. And now he begins to enumerate other seacoast areas along the same origin and same area as the Philistines, cut off from Tyrus and Sidon, every helper that remains, for the Eternal will spoil the Philistines. Now notice who he brands them as. The remnant of the country of Caphtor. So apparently he's talking about Crete, where the Philistines immigrated. Baldness has come upon Gaza. Now that was a token of mourning when you shaved off your hair and sat in ashes and sackcloth. So now, out of terror at the king of the north sweeping down through the Mediterranean seacoast along Palestine, baldness is upon Gaza. Ashkelon is cut off with the remnant of their valley. The last remaining segment of the old area of Ashkelon. How long will you cut yourself? Again, a token of self-affliction, trying to get mercy or forgiveness. Oh, you sword of the Lord. So right away, you know, you should make that the title of your Christian publication, the sword of the Lord, because it's used in the Bible. So you might as well name your Christian publication Jezebel. Might as well name it Satan, you know, or those are in the Bible too. Isn't that odd how somebody just grabs something out of Scripture and Bethesda Baptist Church? What on earth's that got to do with anything? How can a Bethesda Baptist Church be in Pasadena? Bethesda's not in Pasadena. But if it's a Bible name, it's sacred, holy. And that isn't true at all. Oh, you sword of the Lord. Well, they've written a work against us, the sword of the Lord. How long will it be ere you be quiet? Put up yourself into your scabbard, rest and be still. How can it be quiet, seeing the Eternal has given it a charge against Ashkelon and against the seashore? So God is quite accurate here when he just enumerates right up and down the Mediterranean coast, Tyrus, Zidon, Gaza, Philistines, Ashkelon. Well, he's getting very specific. All those areas right along the Mediterranean. And now all of a sudden, against Moab. Now where in the world is that? He talks about Ethiopia, Egypt, Libya, Lydia. Now he's talked about everything along the Mediterranean coast. He talks about Ammon. He talks about Edom. He talks about... But who is Moab? Who is Moab? Is that Iraq? Is that Iran? Is that... Who is that? Well, I wouldn't really say. I don't really know. I'm still trying to figure it out. Concerning Moab. Now, one thing for sure, you look up Moab in a concordance, and they were always hostile to Israel. From way back in Judges chapter 3, through Samuel and Kings, and all the way through the major prophets, they were always hostile to Israel. Well, who is that? It's not Syria. They're named in the Bible. It's not Lebanon. It's not Edom. It's not the Arabs. I mean, in the Arabia, they're named specifically in the Bible as well. Seba and Sheba and the countries that make up Arabia. But who is Moab anyway? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's the other Arabs outside of the Egyptian-led Arabs. Well, let's just read and see if we can find out. But you notice the very brief summary about Philistines covering everybody up and down the coastland there. And he's given a whole chapter that included both Egypt and Babylon. And now all of a sudden he comes to Moab and look what happens. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, Woe to Nebo! not the mountain, but this was a Reubenite possession. You can read back in Numbers 32 that now belonged to Moab. For it is spoiled. Kiriathaim is confounded and taken. Miskab is confounded and dismayed. And why he goes into such great detail about Moab? He names more cities of Moab than everybody else put together. And he really, and back at that time, without any question, originally he's talking about the country over there south of where the Israelites inhabited the eastern part, east of the Jordan River. He talks about areas that include Petra and places like that, but where are they today? Kiriathaim is confounded and taken. Miskab is confounded and dismayed. There are no more praise of Moab in Heshbon, the capital of the Sion king of the Amorites. They have devised evil against it. Come, let's cut it off from being a nation. So apparently when this Babylonian power comes and deals with the Philistines, he's also dealing with Moab, whoever that is now. Also, you'll be cut down, being reduced to silence. Oh, madmen, and that's not a description, but a town, a name of a town in Moab, 12 miles northeast of Dibon. The sword shall pursue you. A voice of crying shall be from Horonaim, spoiling and great destruction. Moab is destroyed. Her little ones have caused a cry to be heard. For in the going up of Luhith, another one that's just a mile west of Mount Nebo, continual weeping shall go up. For in the going down of Horonaim, the enemies have heard a cry of destruction. Flee, save your souls. Yeah, that's the right word, Naphesh. Flee, save your souls. And be like the heath in the wilderness. Or naked trees, another translation of heath. Save your lives, be like naked trees in the wilderness. Because you have trusted in your works and in your treasures, you also are going to be taken. And Chemosh shall go forth into captivity with his priests and his princes together. So here's talking about one of their gods. And the spoiler, apparently talking about the Europe power, the north, is going to come on every city. No city is going to escape. The valley also is going to perish. The plain is going to be destroyed, as the Eternal has spoken. Give wings to Moab, that it may flee and get away. For the cities thereof shall be desolate, without any to dwell there. Now here's a warning, boy. Verse 10 is another, like chapter 45. Cursed be he that does the work of the Eternal negligently. That's more the Hebrew word, not deceitfully. Cursed be he that does the work of the Eternal negligently. Now in this case, he's talking about the power of the north, Nebuchadnezzar, that's God's instrument, doing the work of God, and he has to do it totally and not negligently. But it's a truism anytime. Cursed be he that keeps back his sword from blood. If God has decreed that a sword should shed blood, then it'll shed blood. Now, here he comes back. Moab has been at ease from his youth. And, of course, if you read back in Deuteronomy 2 and verse 10, since Moab drove out the Emims, those giants, they'd had at ease from that time forward. He has settled on his lees, has not been emptied from vessel to vessel, neither has he gone into captivity. Therefore, his taste remained in him, and his scent has not changed. So he didn't stink from coming down into the dung heaps, or he didn't lose his taste by having the taste of captivity and being transplanted into another country and somebody transplanted into his country, and he wasn't poured from one area to another like being emptied from a vessel to a vessel. Who in the world is that? That is Moab, Iraq, and they've always been there, and they've never been emptied from vessel to vessel. They've never gone into captivity. Their taste remains. They've never tasted defeat or tasted captivity. Their scent isn't one of a dungeon or dwelling in a dung heap. Well, that's a description of Moab at ease from his youth. Therefore, behold, the days come, says the Eternal, that I will send unto him wanderers, and this is rather poorly translated here. He's really talking about tilters that'll tilt him and pour him from bottle to bottle. In other words, instead of just dwelling there safely in a bottle, in the future he's going to be tilted and poured to another bottle. So it's keeping up this symbol of a wine jar and being poured back and forth. So in spite of the way he's been in the past, the days are going to come that he is going to be tilted and poured from bottle to bottle. And shall empty his vessels and break their bottles. And Moab shall be ashamed of Chemosh, as the house of Israel was ashamed of Bethel, their confidence. So that's where they had their calves of Jeroboam, you remember, in Bethel. So the same way Moab is going to be ashamed of his God that he's trusted in. How say you, we are mighty and strong men for the war. Well, that's why I thought that was talking about Iran, because they had all the modern military weaponry, you know, and they had weapons they bought from America that we couldn't even afford to put in our own Air Force. They had power that, are they going to come back up like that? Are they, we just misread it? Is this Iraq? Are they going to come up with that kind of power? Are they going to say in the end time, we are mighty and strong men for the war? Well, we already know it doesn't include Egypt and Ethiopia and Libya and Lydia, because they've already been described in a power block. But now he's talking about Moab, and yet they're also one that the king of the north is going to sweep down through like a flood. And yet at the time they say, we're mighty and strong men for the war. Moab is spoiled and gone up out of her cities. His chosen young men are gone down to the slaughter. Saith the king, or is the king's oracle, whose name is the Eternal of Hosts. The calamity of Moab is near to come, and his affliction, haste fast. All you that are about him, bemoan him. So he's not a country stuck out by himself. There are countries all about him. And yet when the king of the north comes down through Moab, the countries about him are going to bemoan him. And all you that know his name say, how is the strong staff broken, the beautiful rod? Who in the world is that talking about? The strong staff. How is the strong staff broken, the beautiful rod? You, daughter, that does inhabit Dibon. So now he comes down to the modern descendant of the old mother power, like he always does. Now he's talking about the daughter that also inhabits the same place the mother did. Come down from your glory and sit in thirst, because the spoiler of Moab shall come upon you, and he shall destroy your strongholds. O inhabitant of Aroer, here again he's just describing cities up by the Arnon River and up in that old area that used to be where Moab was. Stand by the way and espy, ask him that flees and her that escapes, what's done? Where are you going? What's happened? Moab is confounded because it's broken down. Howl and cry. Tell it in Arnon. Again, up at the east side of the Dead Sea, that Moab is spoiled. Judgments come upon the plain country, upon Holon and upon Jahaza and upon Mepheth and upon Dibon, upon Nebo and upon Beth Diblathaim, upon Kiriathaim and upon Beth Gamul and Beth Meon. He's just rattling off cities right and left, upon Kerioth, upon Bozrah, upon all the cities of the land of Moab. Now he tells you what all those are. Far or near, the king of Moab, the horn, is cut off. So whoever's the horn of the king at that end time is going to get cut off. His arm is broken, his strength or his power, says the Eternal. Make you him drunken, which apparently he's going to mix in with other people and get drunk from it, for he magnified himself against the Eternal. Moab also shall wallow in his vomit, and he also shall be in derision. So apparently something he does is so contemptible and so anti-God that God is going to cause him to fall very low, as he describes there. For was not Israel a derision unto you? Was he found among thieves? For since you spake of him, you skip for joy. So this power especially celebrates when Israel goes down. They're going to take great delight in it, great joy in it. Is that going to be Iraq, Iran? Who's he talking about? Oh, you that dwell in Moab, leave the cities, dwell in the rock, and be like the dove that makes her nest in the sides of the hole's mouth. We've heard the pride of Moab. Where is their pride for Iraq? What have they got to have great pride about? What about them would cause you to see these descriptions that Jeremiah pictures here? Well, maybe they'll rise to that between now and the end. We've heard the pride of Moab. He is exceeding proud. His loftiness and his arrogancy and his pride and the haughtiness of his heart. So here you find a good number of six descriptions of pride of a power. I know his wrath, says the Eternal, but it'll not be so. His lies shall not so affect it. I know, therefore will I howl for Moab, and I'll cry out for all Moab. Apparently, the way he words it there, all Moab may include several allies or several countries together. Mine heart shall mourn for the men of Kahiris. And most of these are just areas along the Dead Sea. This is on the southern end of the Dead Sea. A vine of Sibma, I'll weep for you with the weeping of Jazer. Your plants are gone over the sea, or branches. They reach even to the sea of Jazer. The spoiler is fallen upon your summer fruits and upon your vintage. And joy and gladness is taken from the plentiful field and from the land of Moab. Now, you know, the rolling hills that had such rich wheat in Moab in the old days, is that describing Iraq today? Are their limbs going to reach all the way to the sea of Jazer, apparently the Dead Sea? And he always talks about the spoiler. Joy and gladness is taken from the plentiful field, the land of Moab. I have caused wine to fail from the wine presses. None shall tread with shouting. Their shouting shall be no shouting. From the cry of Heshbon, even unto Jahaz, they have uttered their voice from Zoar unto Horonaim as an heifer of 3 years old. For the waters also of Nimrim shall be desolate. Now, if that's talking about the Dead Sea, then even a sea that's normally not that useful is going to end up being desolate. Moreover, I'll cause to cease in Moab, says the Eternal, him that offers in the high places, and him that burns incense to his gods. So they're not a nation that just worships one god. They're a nation that has multiple gods. Therefore, mine heart shall sound for Moab. Now, they may have that plural for gods there, Elohim, might actually apply to different gods in different cities, although they may all be Allah. Therefore, mine heart shall sound for Moab like pipes. And that's the same where Christ said, we've piped to you and you haven't mourned. Funeral pipes. So God's heart sounds for Moab like funeral pipes. God's heart sounds like funeral pipes for the men of Kahiris because the riches that he has gotten are perished. It's going to be an oil power, gaining great riches from oil because the riches that he has gotten. Well, it may well be. Maybe they'll take over territories around them and end up with great oil prosperity. But it's going to be a power that has great riches at the end time. And yet in their punishment, every head is going to be bald, every beard clipped, on all the hands shall be cuttings, all tokens of penance and repentance and trying to bribe gods to let them off the hook. Upon the loin, sackcloth, there'll be lamentation generally, upon all the housetops of Moab. And of course that reminds you of the Israelites on all the housetops worshiping their gods. So now there's lamentation generally on all the housetops of Moab. But is that the way people worship in the Muslim religion, worship Allah on the housetops? No, that's not describing the Muslim religion. And in the streets thereof, where they pray to their gods, for I have broken Moab like a vessel where is no pleasure, says the Eternal. They shall howl, saying, how is it broken down? How has Moab turned the back with shame? So shall Moab be a derision and a dismaying to all them about him. Is it just a term describing all of the Arabs? Well, he's already described Egypt with those others. For thus says the Eternal, behold, he shall fly as an eagle and shall spread his wings over Moab. Kiriath is taken. The strongholds are surprised. The mighty men's hearts in Moab at that day. Notice it's talking about the end days, the time of the trumpets. At that day, the mighty men's hearts in Moab shall be as the heart of a woman in her pangs. And Moab shall be destroyed from being a people, because he has magnified himself against the Eternal. How is he going to do that? In some way, he's always denoted as really celebrating when Israel falls, always magnifying himself against the great God of the Bible. Fear and the pit and the snare are going to be on you, O inhabitant of Moab, says the Eternal. Now, why does he talk about inhabitant of Moab? Does that mean they're not really the old Moabites? So he doesn't say Moabites, he just says inhabitant of Moab, says the Eternal. He that flees from the fear shall fall into the pit. He that gets up out of the pit shall be taken in the snare. Because I'm going to bring upon it on Moab the year of their visitation, says the Eternal. They that fled stood under the shadow of Heshbon because of the force. But a fire shall come forth out of Heshbon, and a flame from the midst of Sion, and shall devour the corner of Moab, and the crown of the head of the tumultuous ones. What is that all talking about? How would you describe Moabites, or people in the land of Moab, as the tumultuous ones? Is it just all the Muslims together, other than the Egypt and Ethiopia, the ones we read of? All the other Muslim countries? Woe unto you, O Moab, the people of Chemosh perishes, for your sons are taken captives, and your daughters captives. Yet I'll bring again the captivity of Moab in the latter days. So they're going to be restored back again later, but thus far is the judgment of Moab. Now concerning the Ammonites, so he names all these other countries in the Middle East. Who is he leaving? Concerning the Ammonites, back in the old days they were north of Moab. Then when the tribes east of the Jordan were carried away by Tiglath-Pileser, then they supplanted Gad. And here's a sin God points out right here. When those tribes east of the Jordan were taken captive, they just moved right in and took them. Concerning the Ammonites, thus says the Eternal, has Israel no sons? Shouldn't they, their land be left to their own descendants? Doesn't Israel have any heir? Then why do you step in there and take their king? Why does your king Ammon inherit the land that should have been Israel's sons, Gad, and his people dwell? Why do your people dwell in the cities that should pass on down to the sons of Israel? Therefore, behold, the day is come, says the Eternal. There again is the Eternal's decree or oracle, that I'm going to cause an alarm of war to be heard in Rabbah. And of course, later that was the very city of Ammon on the highlands of Gilead. And in the days of the Roman Empire, they built a city and called it Philadelphia, whose ruins were there later. It'll be a desolate heap. And her daughters shall be burned with fire. Then Israel shall be heir unto them that were his heirs, says the Eternal. Howl, O Heshbon, for Ai is spoiled. Cry, you daughters of Rabbah. Gird you with sackcloth. Lament, run to and fro by the hedges. Their kings shall go into captivity, and his priests and his princes together. Now, is that talking about the current king of Jordan? Well, if it isn't, it'll be whoever replaces him. Their king's going to go into captivity, his priests and his princes together. Wherefore glory you in the valleys, your flowing valley, O backsliding daughter, that trusteth in her treasuries, saying, who shall come unto me? So apparently they feel secure right before their calamity comes because of their treaties and their dealings with countries in power. Behold, I'll bring a fear on you, says the Eternal God of hosts, for all those that be about you, So, you know, the Jordanians have always kind of been independent against a lot of the other Arab countries all about them. Has God brought a fear on the Jordanians from Syria, from Egypt, from Arabia? In a lot of ways he has. There's been a fear about the Jordanians because they've tried to play the West and their neighbors and try to keep from getting too strong in favor of one or the other. So God said, I'll bring a fear on you from all those that be about you, and you'll be driven out every man right forth, and none shall gather up him that wanders. But afterward, I'll bring again the captivity of the children of Ammon. So very brief comments about Ammon, the Jordanians, says the Eternal. And now he goes to a northern area of Edom, or Esau, or Turkey. Concerning Edom, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman? And, of course, that was one of the grandsons of Esau. Is counsel perished from the prudent? Is their wisdom vanished? Flee you, turn back, dwell deep. In other words, hide out thoroughly, deeply. O inhabitants of Dedan. Of course, that was one of the grandsons of Abraham back in Genesis. I'm going to bring the calamity of Esau upon him the time that I'll visit him. If grape gatherers come to you, now, you know, here he begins to use some of the very words out of the book of Obadiah. Grape gatherers. Obadiah verse 5 talks about the very same thing, grape gatherers coming to you. Would they not leave some gleaning grapes? If thieves by night, they'll destroy it till they have enough, but that isn't the way God is going to be. I've made Esau bare. I've uncovered his secret places, and he'll not be able to hide himself. His seed is spoiled, and his brethren and his neighbors, and he is not. Leave your fatherless children, your young children. I'm going to preserve them alive and let your widows trust in me. For thus says the Eternal, behold, they whose judgment was not to drink of the cup have assuredly drunken. Are you he that shall altogether go unpunished? You'll not go unpunished. You remember when the king of the north comes sweeping down through the Middle East? These three escape, Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Now, how can that be? Who is Moab if the king of the north doesn't bother him when he sweeps through the Middle East? And who is the spoiler of Moab then, if the king of the north leaves him alone? Are the Asiatics going to come through Moab and be the spoiler of Moab? Are the Asiatics going to come through Ammon? You know, if you're Asiatic hordes from the east, how do you get to Armageddon? Well, you've got to go through Jordan, and you've got to go through probably you've got to go through Moab, and you've probably got to go through Syria. If you take the 200 million army out of the east and get them to Megiddo, how do they get there? Well, back here to verse 12. Thus says the Eternal, behold, they whose judgment was not to drink of the cup have assuredly drunken. I've sworn by myself, verse 13, says the Eternal, that Bozrah shall become a desolation, a reproach, a waste, and a curse. Four things again, you notice. God's judgment revealing himself. All the cities thereof shall be perpetual wastes. And interestingly enough, it talks about that back in the book of Obadiah. I have heard a rumor from the Eternal, and an ambassador is sent to the heathen. Gather you together. Come against her. Rise up to the battle. For lo, I'll make you small among the heathen. So, you know, Turkey's never been a great country or a powerful country. They've strategically located. They've been real fighters, but God said they've been made small among the heathen. So you don't expect them to be India or China or Russia or Germany. They're small among the heathen. Despised among men. You know, not the respect that Greeks have had or Romans have had. Your terribleness has deceived you. The pride of your heart, O you that dwells in the clefts of the rock. There again, right out of the book of Obadiah. That holds the height of the hill. Though you should make your nest as high as the eagle, I'll bring you down from there, says the Eternal. And Edom shall be a desolation. Everyone that goes by it shall be astonished and shall hiss at all the plagues thereof. As in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah and the neighboring cities thereof, says the Eternal. So apparently because of their violence and their special viciousness against Israel, their terribleness, verse 16. They're going to be made an example of eternal fire at the first part of the millennium like Sodom and Gomorrah were and the neighboring cities back before. No man shall abide there, neither shall a son of man dwell in it. Behold, he'll come up like a lion from the swelling of Jordan against the habitation of the strong, but I'll suddenly make him run away from her. And who is the chosen man that I may appoint over her? For who is like me, and who will appoint me the time? And who is that shepherd that will stand before me? Therefore, hear the counsel of the Eternal, that he has taken against Edom, and his purposes that he has purposed against the inhabitants of Teman. Surely, the least of the flock shall draw them out. Surely, he shall make their habitation desolate with them. The earth is moved at the noise of their fall. Obviously, the time of the earthquake and the trumpets and the Armageddon. At the cry, the noise thereof was heard in the Red Sea. Behold, he'll come up and fly as the eagle and spread his wings over Bozra. And at that day shall the heart of the mighty men of Edom be as the heart of a woman in her pangs. Well, you know, if Daniel 11 says the king of the north doesn't bother Edom, Moab, and Ammon, and now you read about the power that's going to devastate and terrify them, who's left? It has to be the armies of the Asiatics coming sweeping through, going down through Turkey and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan, all the way into Palestine. So he goes on from there talking about Damascus, the little country of Syria. Verse 23, these are a lot of miscellaneous prophecies about the various countries in the Middle East in the end time. Started talking about the Ammonites, and then he talked about Edom. He talks about their major cities. I don't get too much of a kick out of getting an atlas and seeing what the old cities are today. So if you want to do that, well, have at it, and it'll take you months to get through Jeremiah if you do that. But anyway, he starts talking about Damascus and Syria, beginning verse 23. So just like the book of Amos, he gives you what's wrong with the various countries there and what God's going to do to them. And now he's doing that in Jeremiah, as he will in Ezekiel, and as he did in Isaiah. Now, concerning Damascus, Hamath is confounded. These are other major cities and centers. Arpad, for they have heard evil tidings. They're faint-hearted. There's sorrow on the sea. It cannot be quiet. So here you just see the confusion that reigns when an attack is launched by an enemy, bringing into captivity. Damascus is waxed feeble and turns herself to flee. Fear has seized her, has seized on her. Anguish and sorrows have taken her. Her pangs of as a woman in travail. How is the city of praise not left? The city of my joy. Therefore, her, and that's what their captives are saying as they're fleeing and running in fear. They're saying of their beloved country and cities, how is the city of praise not left, the city of my joy? Therefore her young men shall fall in her streets, all the men of war shall be cut off in that day. There again, always that key phrase showing it's talking about the day of the Lord and the time of the trumpets. Says the Eternal of Hosts, I'll kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad. Of course, the word Ben is just means son of, but there are three separate kings in Damascus, all by this same name. So it became a byword for the palace. The palaces of the three Ben-Hadads, God's going to kindle a fire in the wall and consume the ruling family or dynasty and put an end to their government. Now he starts zeroing in on the Bedouin dwelling in tents east of Palestine, Kedar, the black tents of Kedar in the hills of Moab, and concerning the kingdoms of Hazor, another area near the Euphrates and the Persian Gulf, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, shall smite. Thus says the Eternal, So here again, he's talking about both the old invasion by the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's day and the one in the future by the Babylon of the end time, the king of the north, and showing what's going to happen to Syria when the king of the north comes sweeping down through that area, what's going to happen to Turkey and Jordan. So all these countries you know very well by name and their locations. And now he zeroes in on smaller tribes as he did earlier on the coastland of the Mediterranean, but now he's dwelling more on the Arabs or the Bedouins east and south of Palestine. Arise, you, speaking now to Babylon, go up to Kedar and spoil the men of the east. So here you see when Job was one of the wise men of the east, he's talking about the area in around Arabia and southeast of Palestine, their tents and their flocks, so they're nomad people, they shall take away. They'll take to themselves their curtains, which were just dividers within a tent. If you've seen the old movies, you've seen the curtains dividing off the sleeping area and the banqueting area and the meeting area. All their vessels and their camels, and they'll cry unto them, fear is on every side. Flee, get you far off, dwell deep. In other words, try to hide out somehow by dwelling deep, O you inhabitants of Hazor, says the Eternal. For Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has taken counsel against you and has conceived a purpose against you. And now God once again addresses, as he did up in verse 28, to the king of the north, or the Babylonian Nebuchadnezzar's time, arise, get you up into the wealthy nation that dwells without care. So at the time he's addressing Babylon, these nations allied with Egypt were secure, had a false confidence, and there's no way Babylon would be able to come in and cause any trouble with Egypt. They were in such a power position at this time, and so were all these allies of theirs. So now God describes these nations around Egypt that are allied with them that the Babylonians are told to go down and defeat. Arise, get you up into the wealthy nation that dwells without care. That's a pretty good description of all those Arabs in our day, isn't it? All the oil money and all of their, you know, they got more money than they can spend. One of them even tried to buy the Alamo in Texas. That's really bad news for any Texans anyway. Arise, get you up into the wealthy nation that dwells without care, says the Eternal, which have neither gates nor bars. So apparently they don't have any real defense except their wealth and their location. They dwell alone. Their camel shall be a booty, the multitude of their cattle a spoil. I'll scatter in all winds them that are in the utmost corners. So nobody's going to be able to hide out no matter where they are when the king of the north comes sweeping down through. I'll bring their calamity from all sides thereof, says the Eternal. And Hazor shall be a dwelling for jackals rather than dragons, a desolation forever. Of course, the word forever doesn't mean endlessly. There's another word that means endlessly if God wanted to use it. There will no man abide there, nor any son of man dwell in it. The word of the Eternal that came to Jeremiah the prophet against Elam. Now, of course, that's a common name for Persia, and yet to just toss in one paragraph about Elam doesn't make much sense in an end-time setting, because when you talk about the 200 million army of the Asiatics that's going to come in and defeat the Babylonians, you'd wonder why God would wait and just toss in these few passages about Elam. And yet you begin to see why when you see that Jeremiah 50 and 51 are all written about the power that's going to bring down the Babylonians. As a matter of fact, it's the main place John got his parts out of the book of Revelation, out of Jeremiah 50 and 51. You'll see a lot of the quotes out of Revelation right out of those chapters. So after he's given you a rundown on some of these lesser countries and what's going to happen to them, he just makes a brief comment about the power that's going to be used against the Babylonians. That's kind of an introduction to showing you what's happening to the Babylonians for the next two long chapters. So now he starts about Elam, which almost everybody knows is the Media Persian area, in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus says the Eternal Host, Behold, I'll break the bow of Elam, the chief of their might. And upon Elam, I'll bring the four winds from the four quarters of heaven, and will scatter them toward all those winds, and there'll be no nation where the outcast of Elam shall not come. So at Armageddon, when God intervenes and scatters these Orientals and the beast power, they're going to be scattered into all the winds. And the destruction coming on them is not coming from any one direction from a country, because it's coming from God. So they're going to get it from east and west and north and south. That's the way God's going to fight them, and not some human power bringing them down. Elam's going to be dismayed before them that seek their soul. There again, the word life, showing you can kill somebody's soul. I'll bring evil on them, my fierce anger. In other words, the seven last plagues, God's wrath, is going to be brought on these powers gathered at Armageddon. Says the Eternal, I'll send the sword after them till I've consumed them. I'll set my throne in Elam. So it shows it's at the end time when Christ comes back and sets up a government ruling the nations of the earth. So when John in Revelation 11 says, The kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and His Christ, this is just one of them. The Asiatic hordes depicted here by Media Persia. I'll set my throne in Elam, and I'll destroy from there the king and the princes. Now there's several words for destroy, so you have to always be careful which word you use. When God talks about destroying the devil in Ezekiel 28 or Isaiah 14, it isn't the word for devastate or obliterate. It's the word just mean rendering powerless. You could destroy a sergeant in the police force if you kicked him out of the police force. But you didn't obliterate him. You didn't blast him to smithereens, you know. You just rendered him powerless. So that's one of the words for destroy. I'll destroy, in other words, there aren't going to be any more human kings and princes. It'll come to pass in the latter days. So that's when God sets his throne in Elam, in the latter days. That's when God scatters Elam into all the nations in the world, in the latter days. I'll bring again the captivity of Elam. So after that, God is going to allow them to be brought back to their countries and be put back in their countries and restored to their lands, and then they'll serve under him.